I have the great pleasure of introducing our last speaker of the day, another Dan, and someone who you all know what he looks like at this point, but I'll have other CV details to let you know a bit about his background. So Dan is presently Associate Professor of Pharmacology here at McGill, and like many of us here in the room, he's a hybrid, American and Canadian. He started his research career in reproduction in the States, carrying out his graduate studies at Johns Hopkins, his postdoctoral fellowships at Northwestern, and he established his first lab at the Population Center at Rockefeller University in New York City. Luckily for us, in 2006, he was enticed to join us here at McGill. And today he's presenting a talk on his favorite topic, Mechanisms of FSH Synthesis, The Story of a Pig and a Fox. And I think you'll agree with me, it's not only a creative title, but one that perfectly reflects his sense of humor. Dan.
Thanks, Cindy. I actually hope I still have my sense of humor. I'm really operating on fumes here, which I'm sure is true for many of you in the audience. So if you feel like going to sleep, please go ahead. You won't be the first. I do want to echo the other speakers and thanking the organizers for the opportunity to present our work. So what I do want to do today, and hopefully in a brief period of time, I'm notorious for not respecting time limits. We'll hope that's not the case today, is tell you about, I guess, essentially the last 10 years of work in my lab trying to understand mechanisms of FSH synthesis. And while I may have a cute title, I also don't know how to push a button. What you'll hear from the story is that this title is actually quite apt in explaining our little odyssey and understanding what we at first thought was going to be a simple solution to this problem and turned out to be a lot more interesting and complicated. So for this audience, I don't need to give a detailed background. We already heard some talks, or at least one talk specifically about FSH. This is our one of the hormones that we study in the lab, but more recently been working on luteinizing hormone as well. It's a heterodimeric glycoprotein hormone. Here it's crystal form. I just want to point out that it is comprised of beta and alpha subunits. We heard some data about what happens when you knock out this beta subunit. But I show this to remind myself to tell you that this beta subunit and its synthesis is rate-limiting in production of the hormone. And so our studies have focused on the transcriptional regulation of this FSH beta subunit because that's what actually determines what you see in circulation. You see, because unlike LH, which is stored in secretory vesicles, FSH is constitutively released. So there's a direct relationship between transcription and secretion. So almost by definition, we had to become promoter bashers, even though they've gotten a bit of a bad name today. But we're unapologetic in enjoying that sort of work. But I know you're worried that you're going to see a lot of gel shifts and reporter assays. You'll see a couple, but not too many, because I know how that goes over at the end of a meeting in particular. So FSH is primarily synthesized exclusively, to our knowledge, by gonadotrope cells of the anterior pituitary. And as we heard, it has several functions in the ovary. The ones we hear about most are regulating follicle development, principally by stimulating granulosa cell proliferation and differentiation, and stimulating estrogen biosynthesis by upregulating the expression of the aromatase enzyme. Again, we had some review on this before. FSH, we think about being principally important in driving the final stages of follicle maturation. Here I've written that the initial stages of follicle development in the ovary are hormone independent. I just had a nice conversation with Hugh Clark that maybe that's not true, but that's what the textbook tells us so far. But certainly I don't think anyone would dispute the fact that FSH is critically important in driving the follicles through these last stages of development, which are required for successful ovulation in response to the potent LH surge. We saw some of these data as well, so I won't belabor it, but when Raj Kumar was in Marty Matzik's lab, one of the many things he did was knock out the FSH beta subunit, And what we saw, we heard about before, is a block in follicle maturation at the secondary or preantral stage. And in fact, this phenocopies some clinical conditions, quite rare, not surprising that you would select against this sort of event in any population. But there are some women and men, but I'll talk here more about women, that show up to clinic that are amenorrheic. They never went through puberty and they're infertile. And it turns out that they have inactivating or loss of function mutations in the FSH beta subunit gene that blocks dimer assembly with the alpha subunit. So they're essentially FSH deficient. And so in both human population and in mice, absence of FSH, you have a block in follicle maturation and infertility. Now, what I've shown here schematically, and all of this sort of bumping up and down reflects the fact that I can't draw very well. It could look smoother, but what we're interested in understanding is the selective increase in FSH during the follicular phase of the menstrual cycle, because it's this increase in FSH that stimulates this final wave of follicle development, and in fact the decrease in FSH is also quite critical in terms of selecting a single dominant follicle that will ovulate in a typical human menstrual cycle. Now, it's, of course, difficult to get a handle on mechanism in humans, so we turn to an animal model, rodents in particular, and what I show here schematically is something analogous to what we see in humans. We see, again, selective FSH release relative to LH during the follicular phase, and in rodents, we see what's commonly referred to as the secondary FSH surge, which happens just a few hours, 10 to 12 hours after the primary surge of LH and FSH. And so our initial foray into this area was at least arguing that by understanding this selective increase in FSH in rodents, we might understand mechanistically what's happening in humans. Now, I'll tell you that what we've learned in rodents probably doesn't reflect entirely what happens in humans. We don't have a clear handle exactly about what's going on, but it's not surprising that the processes would not be identical because the secondary FSH surge in rodents is high amplitude, short duration, where you can see that the follicular phase increase in FSH occurs over a much longer period of time. So in rodents, the primary stimulus for this secondary or selective FSH surge is this guy here, activin B, which is a member of the TGF-beta superfamily. And so we know that if we understand how activins regulate FSH-beta subunit expression, we'll have a good handle on how this secondary FSH surge is generated. Okay, so here's my apologetic promoter bashing slide. The way that we've worked out a general mechanism about what's happening, at least in rodents, was using that sort of scheme, using the gonadotrope cell line referred to as L-beta-T2. It's the only cell line on planet Earth that I know about that you can do these kinds of experiments because FSH is very restricted in its expression. Now, I mentioned before that we thought this was going to be simple because there was a general model already about how TGF-beta superfamily ligands signal. And so we figured, well, we'll just work with the existing model and see if it applies here, and it turns out that it did. So typically you'll have activins, which are dimeric proteins. They'll bind to a cell surface receptor, which has intrinsic serine threonine kinase activity. That will lead to the recruitment of a second transmembrane protein. So it binds first to what we call the type 2 receptor, recruits the type 1 receptor. The type 2 receptor phosphorylates the type 1 receptor, activating it. And then you have the formation of this heterotetrameric complex. You have two type 2 receptors, two type 1 receptors. And then now the activated type 1 receptor can phosphorylate signaling proteins referred to as SMADs, and in particular SMADs 2 and 3 are downstream of the activin type 1 receptor. Those SMADs then form a complex with SMAD4, and this heteromeric SMAD complex here is shown as a dimer. It can be more than that. Even a trimer we have evidence for, as do others. Will then accumulate in the nucleus and bind to target sequences in DNA and drive or repress transcription. Now, what's shown here is that these SMADs don't work in isolation. They require DNA binding cofactors. But our work from some of these papers listed here indicated that this model fully applied to activin stimulation of the FSH beta promoter, and in fact that this event could happen independently of a DNA binding cofactor because there was what's called the canonical SMAD binding element, which is an 8-base pair sequence, which can actually bind SMADs with higher affinity independent of DNA binding protein. So it seemed like we had a very simple solution to this problem. We just went with what was out there, and that explained the phenomenon. And evidence in support of the importance of this SMAD binding element came from a comparative analysis of the promoters in mice and in humans, and that 8 base pair sequence that we see in mouse is actually absent in human, and that's actually associated with the differential response to activin in the two species. So what's shown here is a result of a promoter-reporter analysis that shows relative promoter activity over a time course, in this case of activin A treatment, and where we see a time-dependent stimulation of a murine promoter, the human promoter is relatively inert, or at least not stimulated very much by activin. So again, telling us that mechanisms of regulation are going to be different between the two species. If you just focus on this line here, I believe if I can read the symbol, what we did is we just engineered that SMAD binding element from mouse, put it into the human promoter in the same place, and we conferred an activin response. So this was leading to a general argument that we had that for a short duration, high amplitude FSH surge, you needed this SMAD binding element, and the reason that the human had a lower amplitude surge is because it lacked this SMAD binding element, and therefore having this sequence is a prerequisite for potent activin-stimulated FSH-beta transcription. Well, Ava stole this quote from me, but that's okay because I stole it from Huxley. We too had a nice hypothesis that itself was slayed by an ugly fact, but this was a really ugly fact, and it was the pig. So enter the pig in our story. And during the course of these investigations, Simon Rhodes' lab published what at first was a surprising observation to us, and that is that when he took the porcine FSH-beta promoter, put it into the same cell line, and then treated with activin, he got very potent stimulation. And that was surprising to us. These are just two promoters of different lengths. You can see between 20 and 30-fold stimulation. If we do an alignment, again, here's our mouse and rat, another rodent also has that SMAD binding element, but you look at the pig promoter and it lacks that sequence. And so that told us that while this might mediate activin responsiveness of a promoter, it's not absolutely required. So, but we wanted to confirm this result, which we did. This almost looks like the experiment I just showed you, where human wasn't regulated and mouse was, but in this case, this is mouse and this is pig. So we actually showed that the porcine promoter, which lacks this SMAD binding element, is actually more potently regulated by activins than is the mouse promoter. So in order to determine mechanisms by which activin might stimulate this potent transcription of the porcine promoter, again, we employed a comparative analysis, and here we compared pig and human, which have very similar primary sequences in the proximal promoter. So it was quite surprising that we would see such a dramatic difference in terms of fold activin response. Again, potent response of the pig promoter and an almost absent response, absent in this case, of the human promoter. I won't go through all the details, but we did a series of chimeric analyses to try to pinpoint what regions of the promoter were critical, and we honed in on a single base pair, 165 base pairs upstream of the transcription start site, where there was a cytosine in human and a thymine in pig, and we simply made that substitution. We put the thymine into the human promoter, and we conferred an activin response where there was none before. Now, it's clearly not the same as pig, but again, now we had a response where before we didn't have one. And we did the converse experiment. These are all porcine reporters. This is the wild type, which gives us an activin response. And here we substituted the human base pair into that position at 165, and we completely abolished the response. So that told us that we were probably honing in on something important. So we did an in silico analysis and simply asked what might bind to one promoter and not the other. And what came out as different between the two was this fella here called Freak 4, which is now referred to as FOXD1. It's a forkhead transcription factor. We didn't know much about forkhead transcription factors, but we had heard of one. And by we, I mean Pankaj Lamba, who was a postdoc in the lab at the time. And he said, oh, I bet you it's FOXL2. And he said that because it was really the only one that we knew was expressed in the gonadotrope cell. So some of you might know FOXL2 in terms of its expression in the ovary, where it plays important roles in ovary development and, as it turns out, maintenance of the ovarian phenotype. So it's a winged helix 4-KID transcription factor. It has relatively limited expression in the developing eyelid, in the ovary, in the pituitary, and as I just mentioned, in the gonadotropes. It's also expressed in thyrotropes. And in people that have loss of function mutations in FOXL2, they have a condition referred to as BPES. If they have the type 1 variety, women with that condition have premature ovarian failure, which is typically attributed to loss of function of FOXL2 in the ovary. So to make a long story short and to make it so that you don't have to read this painfully elaborate figure, what we were able to show, in fact, is that in the homologous cell, the L-beta T2 cell, we saw FOXL2 binding to the porcine promoter, but we saw very weak binding of FOXL2 to the human promoter. And this is just showing stronger binding with overexpressed protein. I won't show you the data, but if we make that same substitution I mentioned before, the C165T, which conferred an activin response, it then confers higher affinity FOXL2 binding to the human promoter. Okay, so at this point we thought, okay, we've explained why the pig promoter might be active and responsive, why FSH levels are high in pigs, why they have these huge litters. But who cares unless you're breeding pigs? I mean, that, I guess that would be important in that context. But what we thought we had stumbled on was really a pig-specific phenomenon, because, again, if we do this alignment of different species, we went on to map the nucleotides that were mediating the binding of FOXL2, and here's this TC difference between pig and human, and you can see in all other species there's a cytosine at that position, and in mouse you can actually see that there are two base pair differences. So we thought, okay, well, we've really just identified a pig-specific phenomenon until we did another one of those hypothesis-killing experiments. And what we did here is we took those L-beta T2 cells, and instead of treating them with activin, we transfected them with a constitutively active form of the type 1 receptor for activins, and that stimulates a potent increase in FSH-beta mRNA expression. So this is the endogenous gene, not a reporter, although we see similar data with a reporter. And if we use a FOXL2 siRNA, which we validated to knock down FOXL2 expression in the cells, we attenuate the response. So that told us that FOXL2 was also playing a role in activin or activin-like signaling to the murine FSH-beta promoter, even though it lacked this high-affinity FOXL2 binding site. So we won't go through all the details here because I think I'm going too slowly as usual, but suffice it to say that when we looked more proximally in the promoter, we found this identical sequence on the opposite strand, and this time we found that it was conserved across species. So it seemed that in pig we had a unique FOXL2 binding site, but in other species, including mouse and human, we had a more conserved site proximally. These data here simply just show the FOXL2 binding to the murine promoter in that more proximal region. So that takes us essentially up to this point. How am I doing for time, Cindy? Do you know? Yeah. 10? Oh, okay. We're fine. Okay, so that took us to here, and I feel badly that Stella, who worked tirelessly to work out a mechanism for how activins were regulating FSH-beta in the mouse promoter via FOXL2, I'm just going to have to summarize those data here because you don't want to hear about promoter bashing, apparently. That's kind of summarized up here. We identified this proximal 4-KID binding element where FOXL2 binds, and we were able to show that FOXL2 forms a partnership with these SMAD proteins, and in fact, just adjacent to the 4-KID binding element is what we refer to as a minimal SMAD binding element, which is a 4-base pair sequence. So here's the conserved 4-KID binding element. I realize it's hard to see. Right next to it is a conserved SMAD binding element, either 4 or 8 base pairs upstream. She was able to show that either SMAD3 or SMAD4 binds to the adjacent SMAD binding element, that SMAD3 brokers an interaction with FOXL2, and that SMAD2, which is devoid of DNA binding activity, forms a fourth member of this complex that drives transcription of the FSH-beta subunit in response to activin stimulation. So we're left with kind of this summary here, where initially we thought this 8 base pair sequence explained activin regulation of FSH-beta in, in rodents and mice and rats in particular. But actually now we've settled back on the old model where it seems like a more proximal conserved sequence is primarily or is at least necessary for stimulation by activin, and that this 8 base pair sequence actually represents more of a modulatory sequence. So it's not necessary for the response, but it's necessary for a maximal response. So it would be the combined activities of SMADS working with FOXL2 here and SMADS acting alone here that would drive the secondary FSH surge. Okay, so that's all cell lines. Who cares? We wanted to know if this was real. So we turned to real mice, not mouse cell lines. We wanted to first look at the FOXL2 knockout mice. They were not a useful model to us because of this pervasive ovarian phenotype that they have. And actually, most of them, at least in our hands, die perinatally. So it's actually hard to work with them. So Matthias Trier in Germany generated a floxed model. FOXL2 is a single exon gene, so we knew if we were successful in excising that one exon by Cre-Lox strategy, then we would know we have the entirety of the gene gone. So he was generous in providing us with these mice. Now, the first thing we did was to take pituitaries from these FOXL2 floxed mice, which are phenotypically normal, and then we plated them in culture, and then we performed recombination in cultured cells using adenoviruses that allowed us to deliver Cre recombinase. I realize this is hard to see. This shows you bright field microscopy of cells transfected with a control virus, which expressed just GFP, versus a Cre eGFP vector. We get very good transduction of the cells, and this is a DNA analysis confirming recombination of the FOXL2 allele. And then when we look at FSH beta expression by qPCR or FSH secretion by ELISA in the cells, what we see is under control conditions, we have activin induction of FSH beta transcription. And when we recombine the FOXL2 allele, we have a decrease in the basal activity and an abrogation of the activin response. Now, I should mention that the basal FSH beta expression in these cells is almost entirely activin dependent. If you take these cultures and you use a small molecule inhibitor of the type 1 receptor for activins, or you use a protein called follistatin, which binds and bioneutralizes activins, you completely abrogate FSH beta expression. So we think the effect on basal is actually reflecting inhibition of endogenous activin B signaling in the cultures. And what we can see down here is that the secretion pretty much mirrors what we see with FSH beta transcription. So far it's looking good, as these are real cells, not cell lines. So lastly, and this is really a work in progress, usually I don't like to discuss works in progress, but the data look promising. So to get gonadotrope-specific deletion of FOXL2, we crossed the mice to what we refer to as GRIC mice. This is a knock-in model where an iris Cre cassette is knocked into the end of the GnRH receptor locus. That, in essence, generates a bicistronic mRNA that encodes the GnRH receptor and Cre, and that gives us relatively specific expression, or very specific expression, at least within the pituitary gland, specific to gonadotropes. We cross these mice. We have to do this in a particular way because this GRIC allele is expressed in the male germline, which causes both complications and opportunities. I won't go through all the details, but in the end, we generate four different genotypes. One we refer to as the experimental genotype, where there's one essentially Cre allele, two floxed alleles for FOXL2, and then we have three control conditions. Our principal control is just flox over flox with no Cre, although in some cases we also look at the impact of knocking out one FOXL2 allele to see if there's any haploinsufficiency phenotype. There doesn't seem to be, because we actually have to use those mice here to generate the experimental genotype. Okay, so please don't read this. It's just to remind me that we're doing lots of things, and I'm only going to show you a couple of things that we've done. I'll show you data on testis weight and then the beginning of our 6-month breeding trials. And what I would highlight, though, here is that the loss of FOXL2 is predicted to lead to FSH deficiency in both sexes. We would predict that this would lead to diminished testis size in males, although we would anticipate normal fertility because we know in the FSH beta knockouts that they're fertile, even though they have small nuts. Did I say that? Yeah, okay. We expected to see delayed puberty in the females, altered estrous cyclicity, and then either subfertility or infertility in the female because of an impairment in folliculogenesis, again, secondary to FSH deficiency. Okay, so here are the data. If we look at the top, this is showing you paired testis weight in males from the control genotype, flocks over flocks versus the experimentals. This is controlled for body weight, which didn't differ between the genotypes. And we see about a 30 to 40% decrease in testis volume, or in this case, testis weight, consistent with our initial prediction. I mentioned that the six-month breeding trials are in progress, so this is what the data look like as we're gathering them. This would show you the time when animals are paired, in this case males, so they would be paired with a black six female wild type. And then this would be number of days. You can see in some cases we're up to about 3 months. Each circle represents when a litter is born, and I realize it may be difficult to read, but there are numbers inside these circles which reflect the number of pups per litter. And basically what we see is what doesn't appear to be a difference between males of the control and experimental genotypes. You can see here I've just enumerated the average number of pups per litter. We go from about 8.2 to about 6.8 in the experimental. I haven't done statistics yet because this isn't done, but it suggests that our a priori prediction might be right, that we have a decrease in the size of the testes, but no impairment in fertility. Now, if we look at the females, we see, fortunately for us, a different story. Same paradigm here, number of days, each line is an individual, each circle a litter. We look at the controls. These two were just set up recently, about 3 weeks ago, no litters yet. But you can see the others are all producing multiple litters. We have, again, a litter size of about 8.6, but when we look at the experimentals, you can see litters come less frequently, and when they come, they're smaller. The average litter size here is about 3.4. So we're seeing the predicted subfertility, not infertility. But again, this is a work in progress. All right, so allow me to briefly conclude. We think we've established a clear mechanism for how activins regulate the FSH beta subunit in mice. Our comparative analysis enabled us to identify FOXL2 as a critical mediator of activin induction of the FSH beta subunit gene in multiple species, not just pig and mouse. We know that FOXL2 mediates its action in cooperation with SMADs. The important thing to take home here is that there seems to be variation on a common theme. FOXL2 and SMADs work together, but they work together in different ways in different species. And we think that this might explain variation that we, at least part of the variation that we see between species in terms of the dynamics of FSH release. Our preliminary data suggests that FOXL2 plays in the gonadotrope plays an important role in female fertility, likely regulating FSH synthesis, but we haven't shown that yet in vivo. And since I always get this question, the relevance of FOXL2 to human FSH beta expression is that we haven't determined that yet. So here are the people who did the work. This all started with Pankaj Lamba, a postdoc in the lab who believed in FOXL2, and I guess I do now as well. Stella Tran, a PhD student, really picked up and is driving the project now. And then we have several other members of the lab that have contributed in others and important ways. I want to particularly point out Sheng Zhou and Ying Wang, two scientists in the lab that have been really essential in driving this project. And then finally, I would just acknowledge our funding sources and our collaborators who provided the mice. With that, I'll thank you. And if you don't have any questions, I have some for myself.
So we have time for a couple of quick questions.
I must tell you that you've renewed my interest in promotive bachelor.
Oh, okay, thanks. That's because I kept it short, right?
Now I have a question with regard to your promotive bachelor. So that single nucleotide difference between the pig sequence and others, the way you present it seems to me it's obviously assuming FOXL2 in pig is the same as in other organisms in terms of its specificity and activation activity. Mm-hmm. Is that known, or do you guys want to do some cross-species swapping just to make sure that's
Right. So the only thing that we know directly about the pig FSH-beta promoter is what we've done ourselves in the cell line. What happens in vivo, we don't really have a true sense. I mean, the FOXL2 protein itself seems to be highly conserved in its sequence. I don't know for a fact that it's expressed in the pig gonadotrope. There are data that to show that FOXL2 is expressed in human gonadotropes, not necessarily all of them, but within the pituitary you see expression in the gonadotrope. It's also expressed in gonadotropinomas and non-functioning adenomas in the pituitary. So my guess is that if there's conserved expression in human, then it's likely to be the case in pig, but we don't know that for sure, or at least I don't remember that for sure. Yeah.
Sarah?
I might steal your question, Hugh. I apologize if I do. Thanks, Dan. That was a really clear presentation. You didn't say anything about your females. They have smaller litters. They have less frequent pregnancies, it seems. Mm-hmm. So what do the ovaries look like? And if you superovulate them, what kind of numbers do you get from them?
Okay, so the quick answer is we don't know yet. The way that the experiments are generally done in the lab, because mating trials take 6 months, is that as soon as we get the animals, we pump them into the mating trials, and then we do the other experiments after. So those are obviously all things we need to do, and I'm sure many of you in the audience will be hearing from me when we need to do those experiments. Because as you know, I don't think reproduction really happens below the neck. So, yeah.
You?
Well, my question also pertains to the small litters rather than no litters.
Yep.
So it's the idea that what you've done is the spikes, but there remains nonetheless this kind of underlying basal or constitutive secretion production of FSH, and that is sufficient to produce, in some cases, some litters. Because certainly it's less severe than the beta knockout, which I think was pretty much...
Yeah, so... we don't know yet, right? I mean, that's why I'm saying I hesitate to show the data, but, I've given enough talks now to know that if you don't have a mouse with a phenotype, people really aren't interested in what you're talking about. So I'm just glad to provide those data. So we don't know yet. The first couple of litters that we had, and people in the audience can tell me if I'm correct or not, we had one with two babies. They died. I don't know why they died. Certainly the interlitter interval seems to be longer, at least in some animals. It's going to be difficult, I think, to look at profiles of FSH. We'll try. It's hard to take serial samples. I think maybe I was talking to someone earlier today. It's unlike the rat, where you can predict with certainty once you've looked at them for a couple of cycles that, in 3 days it's going to be proestrous. That's more challenging in mice. You can certainly measure estrocyclicity, but I'm not sure you can predict with absolute certainty that tomorrow is estrous. And that's what we would really need to do. Like if we saw evidence of cycles, we'd have to look at basically 4 o'clock in the morning on the morning of estrus to see if the FSH, the secondary FSH surge is blunted. And the other thing I would say, and one thing that's become quite clear to us, is that we think of gonadotropes as a unique entity, that all gonadotropes are the same. And in fact, it's quite clear that's not the case. So one thing, at least that I'm thinking, is that we might be affecting activin regulation of FSH in a subpopulation of gonadotropes. And that might explain why we have a deficiency but not a complete absence of FSH expression. In the culture, I showed you what happened in the culture. It was quite a profound effect. That does seem to be mainly activin regulated. But in vivo, you have a strong contribution of GnRH as well, which is not... fact, which we haven't used in our culture system. So the jury's still out, let's see.
Thank you for your talk. I have a question concerning the SMAD signaling pathway, because it could be activated also by different other factor than actin. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about indirect action for EGF pathway, for example. And you think that could also explain the peak you observe at the beginning of the luteal phase?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've definitely thought about other ligands. I have to admit I've thought mainly about TGF-beta superfamily ligands. If you, again, another experiment done by the Matsuk lab, if you knock out the type 2 receptor for activins, you get a dramatic decrease in FSH and you get infertility. I'm sure you're aware of those data. So that suggested to us that the primary stimuli for FSH-beta transcription in the mouse would be TGF-beta ligands that signal through that receptor. Now, that's not just the activins. So we, BMPs, for example, can use that that receptor. And we've done some work on BMPs. The in vitro data suggest a role. Our in vivo data so far suggest at least that there might be compensation. You can interpret that as no phenotype. So I didn't show those data. But we've looked at other ligands like myostatin. And you might know these are the if you knock out myostatin, you get mighty mouse, you get the muscular mouse. But those animals, as far as we know, there's no evidence of infertility. There are other ligands like TGF-beta itself that use SMAD2 and 3, but gonadotropes don't express the TGF-beta type 2 receptor. It seems to be epigenetically silenced, in case you're interested. So in terms of other ligands, I think you mentioned EGF. I don't know anything about that. All we've looked at in terms of SMAD activation is the C-terminal phosphorylation. If you're talking about EGF or other kinases, that would involve regulation of other sites within the proteins, in particular in the linker region, and we haven't done anything on that.
Because I was thinking there is some article that show that you can phosphorylate the SMAD protein indirectly by EGF receptor, I think.
Okay. You know, again, I'm not familiar with those particular data. I do know of several other kinases that phosphorylate the linker domain. There is one nuclear kinase that phosphorylates the C-terminus that I'm aware of, but I don't know if that's related to EGF signaling or not. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much, Dan. It was a great presentation.